their wall, film of an armed masked jihadi with a prisoner kneeling before him.
We live in an age of religious extremism, an age of terror and violent slaughter.
IS fighters with a line of kneeling captives.
We are locked in a bewildering ideological battle with religious fundamentalism.
It's a battle that's taken most of us by surprise, because religious fundamentalism seems so odd, so alien to our own easygoing way of life. But, you know, it's not. We've been here before, here at home, here at the very heart of our own civilization. Exactly 500 years ago, a breach within Christianity tore Europe, England, and the Church apart. It was the same literalism, the same passionate intensity, the same apocalyptic violence as now. It's our very own jihad. It's called the Reformation.
The Protestant Reformation was also a political and cultural revolution. It unleashed bloodshed, terror, and the destruction of religious art, a combination we recognize all too well. It began with a provincial German monk, and it threatened the most powerful institution in the Western world, the Catholic Church, with destruction.
In England, it led to a hard Brexit, 16th century style, as King Henry VIII broke with Rome and declared himself supreme head on earth of the Church of England. It was a tale of espionage, enhanced interrogation, and horrific death. As a handful of brave and inspired souls fought to introduce the new ideas, and the authorities fought back savagely to stamp out the infection.
So how did one man's simple act of protest in the backwoods of Germany spark a violent revolution that would transform England, Europe, and the Western world?
BBC Reformation, Europe's Holy War. Written and presented by David Starkey. David's walking through the Vatican, Rome.
In the early 1500s, the Catholic Church shaped every aspect of human life. And here in Rome, its head, the Pope, ruled a spiritual empire bigger than the Caesars.
It's hard to overestimate the power of the Catholic Church in the late Middle Ages. It was a vastly wealthy, bureaucratic machine, the very heart of Europe. It controlled education, media, family law. It had its own private language in Latin, and the clergy, whatever their nationality, swore obedience to the Pope, whose toe even kings knelt on the ground to kiss. But its greatest power was over men's minds.
Churches were dominated by a huge painting of the Last Judgment.
Angels with the saved.
When Jesus as judge sentenced each soul to the joys of heaven. Or the eternal torments of hell.
The damned in flames.
It was a terrifying vision.
A black demon poised with a spear.
The church mitigated its stark horror by the doctrine of purgatory. This was an intermediate state between heaven and hell, where the not too sinful soul was purged of its offenses and made fit to enter paradise. You could reduce the amount of time you spent in purgatory by doing good works, saying prayers, going on pilgrimages, giving to the poor. Or you could draw on the good works of others, Jesus, the saints, the Virgin Mary, whose transcendent goodness had endowed the church with a treasury of merit. The Pope dispensed, in return for consideration, of course, this treasury in the form of spiritual IOUs, known as indulgences. These were printed bits of paper that, in return for cold, hard cash, absolved the soul of its offences and acted as its passport to paradise.
The grand architecture of St. Peter's Basilica and Square under a clear blue sky.
Indulgences were often sold to finance church schemes, and in 1517, the Pope's pet project was the rebuilding of St. Peter's on a magnificent scale.
A medieval illustration depicts a monk selling indulgences.
Indulgences were sold across Europe. There was even a catchy advertising jingle. As soon as the coin in the coffer rings, the soul from purgatory springs. It was as though the church had forgotten Christ and become fixated on wealth. And for one German monk, this was an abomination.
A painting of a dark-haired, brown-eyed man with a serious face. David passes through a gate to look at an engraved church door.
On the 31st of October, 1517, Martin Luther very publicly denounced this scandal.
Luther holding a paper to the church door.
According to legend, he strode through the town to the great doors of All Saints Church and hammered up a document for all to see. It was his 95 theses, a mere 95 points of contention with the church's teachings on sin and penance.
Were these the brave hammer blows of fate against the old order, as the traditional story goes? Or was it the equivalent of pinning an agenda on a university notice board, as revisionists suggest? Actually, you know, it doesn't much matter, since nobody disputes the magnitude of the results.
An illustration of a public hanging.
Luther's protest would plunge Europe into two centuries of religious war, unleashing bloodshed and brutality across the continent. All in the name of God.
Wittenberg, Germany. In a pretty town square, a statue of Martin Luther holding open a book stands on a plinth.
Martin Luther was an unlikely revolutionary. In 1517, he was a 33-year-old monk and professor of biblical theology at the University of Wittenberg in Saxony.
Medieval Germany on a map.
Saxony was just one of a jigsaw of small German-speaking states that comprised present-day Germany. Each had its own ruler, but all fell under the overlordship of an elected monarch, the Holy Roman Emperor, who was crowned by the Pope. And all were subject to papal authority and taxation. In the introduction to his theses, Luther wrote of his wish to stir up debate.
The numbered theses in print.
A new invention allowed him to succeed beyond his wildest dreams. Just over 70 years earlier, Johannes Gutenberg had developed his printing press. This piece of technology would transform Luther from a little-known monk and academic into Europe's most published author. And a wanted man.
Luther originally wrote the 95 Theses in Latin, the language of academic and theological discourse. But even within the Latin of the theses, Luther showed himself aware of that wider audience outside the universities. And nine of the theses list the sharp arguments that the laity were using against indulgences. And how, Luther asks, are we going to answer those arguments if the church doesn't reform itself? Well, of course, the church showed no sign of reforming itself. So what Luther did was to write a tract. He called it a sermon on indulgences and grace. and he wrote it in German, and he had it printed.
A man operating an early printing press in the present day.
Experts still marvel at the extraordinary impact of Luther's sermon.
This was the work which propelled Luther to the front ranks of European thought and theology. Until that point, he'd been writing in Latin. But when he did this and published these 20 short propositions in German.
Just one second. So the form in German very closely echoes the 95 theses. These are numbered points.
They're numbered points, but they're reduced. So we have 20 instead of 95. We have short paragraphs.
He's learned how to lecture. I've always said to my students, can you imagine the lecturer concluding and 95thly? Yes.
Well, I think he's learned how to write as well, because this is a work of instinctive brilliance. I mean, he calls it a sermon, but it's nothing like a sermon. Sermons are meant to be endurance tests of repetition and reiteration. And they
last biblical citation.
And
yes.
This can be read aloud in 10 minutes. It's 20 short, snappy points.
A tabloid sermon.
Well, you could say. And it's published in Wittenberg, but unlike the 95 Theses, which circulated only intellectual community, this went viral immediately. It was reprinted in Leipzig, in Nuremberg, in Augsburg, and then in Strasbourg as well. And so by the end of 1518, there were at least 14 editions of this circulating. And by 1520, Luther had written something like 60 original works. Collectively, they had sold several hundred thousand copies, and Luther was now the most published author in the history of printing. And that is an extraordinary transformation for someone who 5 years before had written precisely nothing.
Professor Andrew Pettigrew, University of St Andrews.
Luther's enemies would liken the spread of his ideas to a virus or contagion. And the carrier is the printed word.
A printed page is lifted off the press.
We too are living through a media revolution with the rise and rise of social media. So think of Luther and the printing press as the ultimate Twitter storm, with Luther himself. Pungent, pithy, fearless, often downright vulgar and rude, cutting the self-styled great and good down to size, winning the largest number of followers, and taking on all comers in what? An Arab Spring? A Velvet Revolution? A jihad?
A sign labelled hashtag Luther's Revolution.
In Rome, the Pope, Leo X, was made aware of Luther's attack. But he dismissed it as a quarrel among friars. Rome was a vast, slow-moving legal bureaucracy. But Luther's ideas moved fast. They were getting everywhere. And England was next.
A painting of the prow of a ship on stormy seas.
In March 1518, just 5 months after Luther's protest in Wittenberg, a ship approached the southeast coast of Catholic England.
David's on the banks of the Thames on a grey day.
On board was a courier bearing a letter. The letter was from the Dutch humanist scholar Desiderius Erasmus, and it was addressed to his friend and fellow scholar Thomas More, who'd just joined the inner circle of the government of Henry VIII. Enclosed in the letter was a copy of the 95 Theses. As far as we know, it's the first time that they'd reached England. But Erasmus pays them no particular attention. After all, both he and More, as scholars and freethinkers, had written equally scathing satire on the corruptions of church and state. But they'd kept their satire safely in Latin. Presumably they thought that Luther would do the same.
But Luther didn't respect polite academic convention.
he was spreading his ideas in German.
A stream of Lutheran publications in German, increasingly radical and in ever-increasing numbers, made it to England across the trade routes of the North Sea. And as they did so, Thomas More abandoned his earlier cultivated ironical detachment and took sides. The Lutheran heresy, he decided, threatened the unity of the Catholic faith, imperiled souls, and must be stamped out. Or at least it must be stopped from infecting England.
In a sunny Wittenberg, the twin towers of a church, then people milling around a cafe terrace in the square.
In Wittenberg, Luther's attack on indulgences was evolving into fundamental doctrines. The key one, raising the power of personal faith above the remedies offered by the hierarchy of the church. Mankind was saved, not by prayer or fasting or indulgences, but only by faith in Christ, as told in the New Testament. Anything else was a corruption, an obstacle, and that included Rome.
A painting shows Luther preaching, with Christ on the cross between him and his audience. Now David at the Vatican.
Meanwhile in Rome, the papal condemnation of Luther was reaching its stately climax. On the 15th of June, 1520, after four all-day meetings, the Pope and his council issued the formal decree known as a bull and entitled, after his opening words, Exsurge Domine, Arise, O Lord. Learning a little from Luther himself, the bull employed the strongest and most violent language, and, printed in pamphlet form like this, it too became an instant bestseller.
Luther was given 60 days to recant or be excommunicated, which meant expulsion from the church and condemnation to the eternal fires of hell.
From a pamphlet cover being removed from the press to David in the church.
His works were ordered to be burned.
Far from backing down, Luther seemed energized, liberated even, and in a matter of a few mere weeks produced three crucial works that between them amounted to a manifesto for a political and religious revolution. The most important of them was addressed to the Christian nobility of the German nation. Writing in German, Luther called on the German princes unilaterally to reform the German church and rescue it from the clutches of Rome that was bleeding Germany dry. Brilliantly targeted, seething with hatred of Italians and Jews, here was the rampant, uninhibited voice of German nationalism. And it sold like hot cakes.
But Luther went further. On the 10th of December 1520, he publicly burned the papal bull. There could be no going back.
A painting shows Luther holding the document over a fire.
In January 1521, Martin Luther was formally excommunicated from the Catholic Church. 2 months later, he was charged with heresy and summoned to a hearing in front of the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V and representatives of the Church. The Imperial Diet, as it was known, was to be held in the German city of Worms. While Luther remained in Wittenberg, he was safe. But a journey to Worms would take him through less friendly German states, risking kidnap, torture, execution. Luther's survival had, to date, been ensured by Frederick the Wise, Elector of Saxony. Frederick now secured a promise of safe passage, and Luther set out.
If the Catholic Church was hoping to destroy Luther at Worms, it had badly miscalculated the popular mood. Everywhere he went, he was hailed as a hero. 100 horsemen rode through the city gates to escort him inside. And as he descended his carriage, a monk reached out to touch the hem of his robe.
By taking on the power of the church, Luther had become a local legend, a figurehead for a populist anti-establishment movement that was spreading across the German-speaking states as resentment about taxes and foreign interference grew.
The Pope's ambassador at Worms was horrified as he reported back to Rome. "The whole of Germany is in full revolt," he wrote. 9/10 raised the war cry, "Luther," whilst the watchword of the other 10th, who are indifferent to Luther, is "Death to the Roman Curia."
An illustration of Luther at an assembly.
Summoned before the Diet, Luther was ordered to renounce his heretical writings. He refused. "Here I stand," he is supposed to have declared. "I can do no other."
David walking over a carpet of leaves in a forest, then resting his hand against a tree.
Whilst the Emperor Charles V and the Diet were debating Luther's fate, Luther's safe conduct was honoured and he was allowed to leave Worms. As Luther and his two companions were riding through thick forest, suddenly, they were ambushed by a posse of armed and masked highwaymen.
An illustration of the ambush.
Luther's companions were overpowered at the point of a sword. Luther ordered down from his wagon and flung on the back of a horse and spirited away. No one knew where or by whom.
David carries on through the forest. Whitehall, London. The Ministry of Defence's stark neoclassical facade, with a pair of stone figures on plinths flanking the pillared entrance.
Back in England, the figure of Martin Luther, this curious German monk, was beginning to register with the authorities.
David enters.
Cardinal Wolsey, the Lord Chancellor, had a palace here in Whitehall at the time. He had eyes and ears everywhere, and one of them, Cuthbert Tunstall, had been dispatched to Worms.
In a corridor.
Cuthbert Tunstall was an outstanding figure of the early Renaissance in England. Educated in different countries, multilingual and a polymath, he was scholar, lawyer, and theologian. Wolsey talent-spotted Tunstall early, and in 1520 he was given the plum post of ambassador to the young Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V. As such, he accompanied the Emperor to the Diet of Worms, from which he sent an extraordinary series of dispatches, mostly in cipher. And the dispatches finished up here, in what was then Wolsey's great town palace in Westminster.
Tunstall was the first Englishman fully to understand the threat presented by Martin Luther, and he gave Wolsey a stark warning.
This dispatch was written on the 29th of January 1521, around the time of the opening of the Diet of Worms. In it, and with extraordinary prescience, Tunstall explains how Luther's shift of language from Latin into German had turned him into a mortal enemy of the church. And then he goes on to recommend what had to be done to stop the threat spreading to England. Wolsey must, he says, call before him the printers and booksellers and give them a straight charge that they bring none of Luther's books into England, nor that they translate none of them into English, lest thereby might ensue great trouble to the realm.
Tunstall's hair-raising dispatch from Worms galvanised Wolsey into action. ordered a ceremonial burning of Luther's books.
David watching a book being consumed by flames. Rome and other cities light up on the map.
It was to be one of many book burnings all over Europe in response to the Pope's condemnation of Luther.
The names of London, then Paris, light up.
And it was one of the most spectacular.
A gold statue of St. Paul holding a cross.
It took place here in the precinct of Old St. Paul's Cathedral on the 12th of May, 1521. As books were tossed onto the bonfire before a vast crowd, John Fisher, Bishop of Rochester, preached a two-hour sermon against Luther and his perilous heresy.
Fisher's sermon was in English, but the books burned whilst he spoke were in Latin or German. This meant, for the time being at least, in England, Lutheranism was someone else's problem. The book burning itself was aimed largely at a foreign audience. Also aimed at a foreign audience was the book that Wolsey brandished in his hand throughout the ceremony. It was the unfinished draft of a Latin treatise against Martin Luther, and it was being written, Wolsey and Fisher loudly proclaimed, by none other than King Henry VIII himself.
A square tower with turrets at the entrance to Lambeth Palace, London.
2 months after the book burning at St. Paul's, Henry's manuscript was printed by the king's printer. It was entitled Assertio Septem Sacramentorum, Defense of the Seven Sacraments. It was a strike against Luther's biblical fundamentalism and dedicated to Pope Leo X himself.
It was also, thanks to Tunstall's reports from Worms, bang up to the minute. In his key dispatch of the 29th of January, Tunstall had informed Henry and Wolsey that Luther's latest book committed the ultimate heresy of reducing the traditional seven Catholic sacraments to only three. Henry's book, called The Defense of the Seven Sacraments, was a powerful reassertion of the traditional number and doctrine.
David's in a library with Professor Richard Rex of Queen's College, Cambridge.
Richard, we're looking here at a first edition of Henry's book. Explain to me, seven sacraments, what actually is a sacrament?
Well, the seven sacraments of the Catholic Church are held to be the guaranteed means, really, by which the benefits of Christ's saving work are communicated to the faithful.
In other words, the sacrament is part of the soul's progress to salvation.
That's right. The merits, as they would say in the late Middle Ages, the merits of the passion and death of our Lord Jesus Christ are communicated first of all in baptism and then at various stages of life, for example, through the Eucharist, through the ritual meal of bread and wine or the body and blood of Christ. Confession, because it was expected that everybody should make a full and proper confession of their sins before receiving the Eucharist. And then there were the sacraments that marked, for the most part, stages of life. Confirmation, marriage, of course, and then at the end of life, extreme unction, as it was known then, the final anointing, which would prepare the body and soul for the separation of death.
So why is it then that Luther feels so passionately, first of all, that the number has to be reduced, and questions, in some ways, the fundamental doctrine of a sacrament itself?
Luther and the other Protestant theologians after him are concerned that with any sacrament that should deserve the name, Christ himself should be shown to have instituted it. And it is with baptism and the Eucharist that they're happy. The other sacraments are, as it were, not instituted by Christ.
So our assertio, what is the impact of it? I mean, there weren't many books by kings, were there? There were very few in Latin.
Its impact was substantial for a few years, I think not least because of its royal authorship. Between 1522 and 1524, there were 8 or 9 editions of this text at places as far apart as Cologne and Rome.
He's almost getting up there with Luther, isn't he?
Well, he's a fair way short of Luther, it has
but
to be said.
Still,
but he's ahead of most of Luther's Catholic opponents at this point.
That is itself something really astonishing, isn't it?
It's
so
quite
England really is, and England's king is seen and sees himself as Martin Luther's principal opponent.
Yes, he's taking this and himself very
King
seriously.
King David confronting, you know,
the
German Goliath.
A bordered title page inside the book.
The Pope's own copy is a magnificent illuminated manuscript bound in cloth of gold and with verses chosen by Wolsey inscribed in the King's own hand. The manuscript, as Wolsey foretold, was laid up amongst the treasures of the Vatican Library, where it still remains. And Henry was given the papal title of Defender of the Faith, which Queen Elizabeth II still proudly holds.
A town surrounded by forest, with mountains in the distance.
Henry had established his credentials as the Pope's most loyal ally. But where was Luther? Luther's mysterious disappearance on the way home from Worms occasioned his followers much anguish. But it wasn't a kidnapping or an assassination by the stooges of the Pope or the Emperor. It was a rescue by the agents of Luther's protector, the Elector Frederick the Wise, charged with bringing him to a place of safety. And they brought him here, to the isolated, almost impregnable Wartburg, high on its towering peak.
The towering fortress of Wartburg Castle, Germany.
Here in Wartburg Castle, Luther went undercover.
David enters through an archway.
He grew his hair and beard and became Junker Georg, or Squire George. Confined to his room, Luther embarked on the next stage of his religious revolution.
The medieval church used St. Jerome's 4th century Latin translation of the Greek New Testament. Known as the Vulgate, it was treated as the sole authoritative text, and crucial Catholic doctrines depended on its particular choice of words.
All Luther's religion was rooted in the Bible. He believed in sola scriptura, that the Bible was the sole infallible guide to faith and practice. So Luther decided to use his time in the Wartburg to start afresh and to make his own new translation of the Bible from the original Greek into German. But it was to be his German, pungent, pithy, and comprehensible by all Germans, north and south. And above all, it was to be his, Luther's, reading of the Bible.
The thing that strikes an English reader is how much there is of Luther in it. He, at times, as far as I can see, doctors the translation to make it clearer.
Luther does, at certain points, he introduces nuances into his translation to reflect his theological beliefs. The most famous is, of course, when he translates man is justified by faith alone. Alone is nowhere to be found in the Greek original, but Luther is convinced it has to be faith alone because that's the way... That's the way the Greek must be translated in German. But of course, Luther was on a mission when he translated his New Testament. It was fundamental for him to deliver the unabridged, in his view, gospel to the Germans.
Setting aside its religious impact, what is its impact on the German language? As I understand it, and I'm no German expert at all, it really is one of the fundamental texts of modern German.
Yes, it is. It's very influential for modern German because it was so widespread and it was read by so many people. Luther didn't invent modern German, but he was quick to embrace certain changes in syntax and grammar that had already been around in his time, and he adopted a sort of German that was could be understood by a large by many people. He says of himself, he doesn't speak any particular German dialect, but speaks or writes in a German that can be understood as well by the
Bavarian,
as a Bavarian or a low German speaker.
Published in September 1522, Luther's Bible began to fix a standardized modern German language. It forged a growing sense of nationhood and national identity amongst the German states. And that helped turn Luther's religious revolution into a political revolution as well.
Luther's revolution now threatened to carry all before it. The princes were attracted by the political and economic power it gave them, and the common people by the freedom and the autonomy that it seemed to promise them.
The term Protestant was coined in 1529, and in 1531, the Lutheran cities and principalities united themselves into a defensive alliance known as the Schmalkaldic League. In little more than a decade, half of Germany had gone Protestant, gone Lutheran.
Gory illustrations showing dismemberment and lynchings.
As Europe began to fracture along religious lines, it would be engulfed by apocalyptic violence. Waves of holy war, terror, and iconoclasm of the kind we are all too familiar with today.
Gloucestershire, England. An old stone church with a square tower and a graveyard.
In England, Luther's revolution was being held at bay by Henry VIII's Catholic government. But in the mid-1520s, one man would challenge that.
William Tyndale was a Gloucestershire man through and through. He studied at Oxford before returning to his native county as a chaplain and tutor to a rich and well-connected family here at Little Sodbury. Tyndale was a natural linguist. He also had a powerful religious conviction, and he combined the two in his life's work to translate the Bible from the original languages into English.
Tyndale was risking his life by confronting the church authorities. They only banned translations of the Bible, he said, to keep the world still in darkness and to exalt their own honour above God himself. And he was resolute. His work would change that.
David leaves the church.
In 1524, Tyndale slipped out of the country and took refuge in Germany. There, he found the support and protection needed to undertake his subversive work.
Printing blocks.
The following year, in 1525, his translation was complete. German presses began printing his English translation of the Bible. Even in Germany, this was a dangerous enterprise. Catholic spies were everywhere.
The printing of Tyndale's English New Testament began secretly in Cologne. An edition of 3,000 copies was well underway when it was accidentally uncovered by a fierce opponent of Martin Luther called Johann Cochlus. The presses were stopped, Tyndale fled with the printed sheets, and Cochlus informed Wolsey and Henry of what had happened in blood-curdling terms. There was an underground plot, he wrote, and the heretics had sworn to turn England Lutheran willy-nilly.
A black and white illustration shows peasants attacking the clergy.
Inspired by Luther's attack on the Catholic Church and fiercely resenting papal taxes, German peasants were rising up to win greater freedoms. Reports of the peasants' revolt made Henry's court extra jumpy. They were terrified the insurrection might spread to English soil.
David's shadow slides across a brick wall, then his black leather shoes pass through a shaft of light.
the king and Cardinal Wolsey relaunch the campaign against Luther and his followers in England.
A sign for Steelyard Passage.
The dirty work was left to Sir Thomas More.
On the 26th of January, 1526, More led an armed raid on the Steelyard, the Thameside London depot of the German merchants of the Hanseatic League. Twilight was falling, and the merchants were about to sit down to their supper when More and his men burst into their hall. The doors were locked and guarded, and More harangued the merchants, accusing them of possessing and importing Lutheran heretical books. Three of them were arrested on the spot, and others the following morning, when More returned to the Steelyard to conduct a room-by-room search.
Those found in possession of heretical works were interrogated, some by Wolsey himself. Overawed, they confessed and recanted.
St. Paul's Cathedral.
On the 11th of February, another book burning was staged at St. Paul's, and the contrite Lutherans were subject to public humiliation.
Figures in silhouette around a blazing fire.
They were paraded three times round the fire, bearing faggots of wood kindling, which, at the end of their ordeal, they cast into the flames as an awful warning of what would happen to their bodies if they offended again.
But despite the warning, heretical books were still being smuggled into England.
A medieval text.
Including, for the first time, Tyndale's translation of the Bible into English.
Karen, we're looking at one of the world's most important, rarest books. The first New Testament in English, translated by William Tyndale, first complete version of it. And I'm struck by, it's really rather a handsome, dignified book.
It is indeed. It's actually very beautifully printed.
Have we any idea at all of how long this would have taken to do?
There was a first edition at printing the New Testament translated by Tyndale in Cologne, printed by Peter Quintel, which, as you know, was then interrupted. The printing process was then interrupted. They grabbed the sheets and ran to Vence, where this edition was produced. And it's thought that that first copies of this particular 1526 edition were already sold here in England in February 1526. So it must have been probably even produced at the end of 1525, beginning of 1526.
It is weeks. Do we have an idea of quantities? Three surviving?
Yeah.
Is there any guess as to what the size of the first edition might have been?
The first edition in Cologne was about 3,000. The 1526, this one, was supposed to be about between 3,000 and 6,000. So quite a large number.
It's a lot.
It is a lot. I mean, there was a market for it in England. It couldn't be produced there, but they knew they could sell it if they could get the copies over to England.
People treasure it, clearly, as a source of revelation.
Absolutely.
We have accounts, don't we, of people, in a sense, they know the Bible exists, they hear it, but suddenly in their own language.
Yeah, and it's not interpreted for them by the priests, which is obviously the great revelation. And it's a very, very accessible language. He uses a lot of verbs, so he makes the language come alive and the word of God come alive to people. Somebody does something or says something rather than
Eat, drink, and be merry. We're just that point. Three verbs.
And three verbs we still use today in everyday language where people probably don't necessarily realise where it comes from.
A stream of heretical works followed Tyndale's New Testament to England, all in multiple printed copies, and all in English.
Flames flickering in the darkness. David sitting by a fireplace.
The appearance of heretical printed books in English was a game changer. Back in 1521, when he'd been an appalled observer at the Diet of Worms, Cuthbert Tunstall had realised that the key to Martin Luther's success was the fact that all his books be in the German tongue and in the hands of every man that can read. Now, William Tyndale's books were in English, and likewise in the hands of every man that can read.
But it would be in the hands of a woman that Tyndale's books would wreak destruction on the Catholic Church in England.
A castle bordered by a moat, manicured lawns and a maze. Hever Castle, Kent.
Hever Castle in Kent was the childhood home of Anne Boleyn, Henry VIII's mistress and eventual second queen. She was also the femme fatale of the English Reformation.
Anne seems to have been a bright girl, and her father, an ambitious Tudor courtier, decided to capitalise on the fact by giving her an excellent education. So, at the age of about 10, Anne was sent to the continent to learn French and to perfect herself in the art of get your man, known as courtly love. Anne's father had married a duke's daughter. Anne, thanks to her excellent training, would do even better.
A portrait of Henry VIII hanging in a wood-paneled chamber.
Early in the 1520s, Anne returned to England and became lady-in-waiting to Queen Catherine of Aragon. It wasn't long before she caught the king's eye. Catherine was vulnerable, 5 years older than Henry. She was approaching 40. And she'd only given him a daughter instead of the longed-for son and heir.
David stands at the window in a four-poster bedchamber.
Henry and Anne spent the Christmas of 1526 apart. Henry at court and Anne in seclusion here at Hever. But around New Year's Day, 1527, in an exchange of letters, they agreed to marry. First, however, there was the little matter of divorcing Catherine. Probably Henry assumed that it would be straightforward. He thought that he had an unimpeachable moral case based on the Bible itself. Catherine was the widow of Henry's elder brother Arthur, who died in 1502. But the Bible, in the book of Leviticus, declared, "If a man shall take his brother's wife, it is an unclean thing. He hath uncovered his brother's nakedness. They shall be childless." What could be clearer? Henry fixated on this verse and clung to it like a lifeline. Henry also thought, understandably, in view of his defense of the church against Luther, that he was in good standing in Rome. What could possibly go wrong?
He looks out at the gardens.
Henry ordered Wolsey to get the Pope to divorce him from Catherine of Aragon. But in May 1527, the mutinous troops of Catherine's nephew, Charles V, sacked Rome. And the Pope became little better than his prisoner in the Castel Sant'Angelo. Henry's services to Rome were nothing against this brutal turn of events.
But Henry and Wolsey blinded themselves to the facts for the next 2 years, which led Henry to the greatest humiliation of his whole reign, when in 1529, the public trial of his marriage to Catherine was aborted on the direct orders of Pope Clement VII himself. Wolsey fell as Henry's struggle for divorce destroyed yet another opponent of Martin Luther. And Henry himself was left looking for a new policy.
David passes a portrait of Pope Clement, who has a long silver beard and wears a scarlet cap and robes.
Anne Boleyn, meanwhile, had not been idle. She proved more clear-sighted than Henry and far more willing to take risks.
Anne had been introduced to advanced religious opinions in France, and she continued and deepened her interest in them in England. So much so that the Spanish ambassador, who was a bitter enemy, called her more Lutheran than Luther.
There's no doubt that Anne was sincere in all of this, but her self-advancement was involved as well.
In 1529, Anne took a gamble and set out to turn Henry. She showed him a copy of an heretical book by the Lutheran William Tyndale. It was called The Obedience of a Christian Man. Anne even marked up passages for Henry's special attention.
Passages like this, no doubt. The king is in the room of God, and his law is God's law. According to Christ's own teaching, Tyndale argued, everybody, churchmen and laymen alike, was under the absolute power of the king. In contrast, the authority of the Pope and his presumption in daring to judge kings was a shameful and irreligious usurpation. For Henry and Anne, it was a eureka moment. This is a book for me and all kings to read, Henry said.
He closes the cover of The Obedience of a Christian Man.
Henry had found a theological justification for dethroning the Pope. England was on the road to its Tudor Brexit.
10 years previously, Henry had written a book to defend the papacy. Now he set up a kind of think tank to destroy its power. The Royal Library was augmented with scores of weighty tomes, all carefully catalogued and cross-referenced, and a team of scholars working closely with the king himself combed them to find historical evidence that the kings of England had been, in practice, as well as in Tyndale's theory, free from papal jurisdiction. And, to Henry's satisfaction at least, they found it.
Seeping black ink.
In 1533, Parliament passed the Act in Restraint of Appeals, which repudiated the authority of Rome and declared England to be an empire governed by one supreme head and king.
Protected by the Act, Thomas Cranmer, the newly appointed Archbishop of Canterbury, declared Henry's marriage to Catherine invalid and his marriage to Anne, good. A week later came the moment that Henry and Anne had been waiting for. On Whitsunday, the 1st of June, Cranmer crowned Anne Queen in a magnificent ceremony in Westminster Abbey. After 6 long years, Henry had got his divorce at last.
David crosses a castle courtyard with lawn on either side.
The great anti-Lutheran defender of Rome was now its bitter enemy. It was Henry's turn to be threatened with excommunication and the eternal flames of hell. Henry's reply was devastating. He had himself styled supreme head in earth of the Church of England only under Christ by an Act of Parliament. To all intents and purposes, Henry had made himself Pope in England.
The tables were now turned, and with the divorce and the break with Rome, victims and victors exchanged roles almost overnight. Lutheran heretics became government agents. Others were even made bishops, whilst their erstwhile Catholic persecutors found themselves, if they remained loyal to Rome, facing imprisonment or death.
Henry's most prominent victim was Sir Thomas More. More had succeeded Wolsey as Lord Chancellor and intensified the campaign against the Lutheran heresy.
A portrait of More shows him tight-lipped and gazing off to the side.
When the clergy were bullied into recognising Henry as supreme head of the church, More resigned. Thereafter, he was a marked man.
More was tried for treason for refusing to recognise Henry as supreme head of the church.
Despite the doubtful evidence against him, the jury took only 15 minutes to find Moore guilty. Moore then dropped his guard and spoke his mind. Parliament could not make the king supreme head of the church, he said, since England, being but a small part of the church, could not make a particular law disagreeable to the general law of the church. It's Remainer versus Brexiteer, and the Chief Justice, in dismissing Moore's arguments, came down firmly on the side of national parliamentary sovereignty.
Tintern Abbey, Monmouthshire. The roofless grey stone abbey ruins, with its arched windows glassless but intact.
Thomas Moore was beheaded in 1535. And the forces of Roman Catholicism in England found themselves in headlong retreat.
David's walking through the grounds.
Between 1536 and 1540, Henry laid waste to the monasteries, plundering their riches and executing those who refused to renounce the papal supremacy. Dotted all over England, these cold, bare, ruined choirs, as Shakespeare called them, are the most visible monuments of Henry VIII's brutal triumph over the wealth and power of the Catholic Church. But though Henry broke with Rome, he never joined with Luther. Instead, he steered a careful middle way between Wittenberg and Rome. So, crypto-Lutherans, like Cranmer, became powerful counselors, providing they kept their faith under wraps. And crypto-papists, like Tunstall, remained in high favor too, providing they acknowledged the royal supremacy. But step out of line in either direction and a horrible death loomed, as in 1540, when, to vindicate his middle way, Henry burned three Lutherans and disemboweled three Catholics, all on the same day.
An illustration showing the three Lutherans on a bonfire. Now the battlements of a circular, fortified castle.
Luther's Reformation was fueled by religious fundamentalism and political opportunism. Henry's was triggered by lust and a hunger for dynastic power. Henry's middle way would subject England to a long, hard Brexit. It unleashed decades of religious schism, terror, and political violence as Catholics and Protestants vied for supremacy. It would drive a wedge between Britain and the rest of Europe that shapes our politics and culture to this day. It would also be the defining moment of Tudor England.
Henry's Reformation was as much about England and Englishness as Luther's was about Germany and Germanness. But Henry did more than print propaganda. He also built real physical defences, like this castle at Deal in Kent, to protect an heretical England against invasion from a hostile Catholic Europe. Most importantly, Henry fostered the idea of empire. Under Henry, empire meant national self-government under the king. But under Elizabeth, Henry's daughter by Anne Boleyn, and her successors, empire came to mean the government of others, by a rampantly self-assertive nation, confident through its reformed religion of its God-given right to rule the whole world.